Thank the board operator, Ozzy Flamenco, and assistant producer, Gary Scott. Thank you, Gary Baca. Remember, everyone, to find ways to be well in the midst of it all. One love.
Hi, this is Angelique Kidjo, and you're listening to People Powered Radio, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at www.kpfk.org. If you believe in radio not sponsored by corporations, but sponsored by you, the people, please call and make your pledge at 818-985-5735. That is 818-985-5735. Peace and love.
FM KPFK Los Angeles.
Good evening. It's Friday, December 5th. I'm Max Pringle. Coming up, the Supreme Court agrees to consider the constitutionality of the Trump administration's order undoing the right to birthright citizenship. A federal vaccine advisory committee has voted to overturn the long-standing recommendation that all newborns in the U.S. be vaccinated against the hepatitis B virus within the first day or so after being born. Prosecutors say the suspect arrested for placing pipe bombs at the Republican and Democratic Party headquarters in Washington the night before the January 6, 2021 U.S. Capitol attack had been motivated by online conspiracy theories about the 2020 election results. The latest government report shows inflation slowed a bit in September, likely clearing the way for the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates again at its next meeting next week. Satellite images show mass graves have been dug in the city of El Fasher, where RSF rebels have taken control of the northern Sudan city and carried out wide-scale atrocities, according to human rights experts. And the recalled Alameda County District Attorney announces she's running to get her old job back next year. These stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Max Pringle. The Supreme Court will take up the Trump administration's order undoing the right to birthright citizenship and whether it's constitutional. Lisa Dwyer has more.
Trump's order says that children born to parents who are in the U.S. illegally or temporarily are not considered American citizens. The justices will hear Trump's appeal of a lower court ruling that struck down those citizenship restrictions. Birthright citizenship is the first Trump immigration-related policy to reach the Supreme Court for a final ruling. The case will be argued before the Supreme Court in the spring, with a definitive ruling expected by early summer. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
A prosecutor says the man accused of planting pipe bombs outside the headquarters of the Republican and Democratic National Parties in Washington on the eve of the U.S. Capitol attack in 2021 told investigators he bought into conspiracy theories about the 2020 presidential election being stolen from President Trump. Ed Donahue reports.
The man accused of planting a pair of pipe bombs outside the headquarters of the Republican and Democratic National Parties in Washington on the eve of the Capitol riot made his first court appearance. Sources tell the AP Brian Cole Jr. confessed to investigators and also indicated he believed the 2020 election was stolen and expressed views supportive of President Trump. Cole was ordered to remain in jail. He did not enter a plea and is due back in court in about 10 days. An FBI affidavit says investigators identified Cole as a suspect through analysis of credit card charges related to the purchase of pipe bomb components, information from cell phone towers, and a license plate reader. The bombs were rendered safe at the time. No one was hurt, but the FBI says the devices could have been lethal. Ed Donahue, Washington.
A federal vaccine advisory committee has voted to overturn the longstanding recommendation that all newborns be vaccinated against hepatitis B within 12 hours of birth. Hepatitis B is a highly contagious virus that can cause severe liver disease and cancer. The American Academy of Pediatrics denounced the decision, calling it a dangerous move that will harm children. Eileen Alfandari has more.
Health officials have recommended since 1991 that the hepatitis B vaccine be administered to all babies soon after birth. Now, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s hand-picked vaccine advisory committee has reversed that recommendation. When she was asked why the newly appointed committee decided to re-examine the vaccine, committee member Vicki Pebsworth cited what she called pressure from stakeholder groups wanting the policy to be revisited. Pebsworth is a nurse who has claimed, without evidence, that vaccines caused her son's autism.
We're doing this because of concerns that have been raised by some groups. The current policy is misaligned relative to existing recommendations in most other developed countries. We need to address stakeholder and parent dissatisfaction that we have become aware of.
The new recommendation says if a pregnant person tests negative for hepatitis B, the first in the three vaccine series can wait until the baby is 2 months old. Dr. Paul Offit is a pediatrician and internationally recognized expert in virology and immunology. He said the recommendation ignores the fact that newborns are susceptible to contracting the highly contagious disease from carriers who may not even know they're infected. Offit does not serve on the vaccine advisory committee.
Most people have chronic hepatitis B infection, don't know they have it. There's millions of people in this country who have chronic hepatitis B. You don't know whether or not you're coming in contact with someone like that. And if you're a child that comes in contact with that, say between 1 and 5 years of age, you have a roughly 25% chance of going on to develop cirrhosis, which is chronic liver disease, or liver cancer, which will shorten your life. If you get hepatitis B is in the first year of life, you have a 90% chance.
The advisory committee also approved a recommendation saying that a baby's blood should be tested for antibodies after the first hepatitis B vaccination, and based on the results, the final two doses could be skipped. Committee member and pediatrics professor Dr. Cody Meisner said there was no basis for that recommendation either.
I mean, it's like Never Never Land. We discussed yesterday, I think pretty carefully, that serology is not an adequate basis for deciding whether someone's immune. If a person has greater than 10 milli international units of antibody after one dose, the implication is that's enough and they don't need any more. We have no basis for saying that. That's been kind of pulled out of the air.
Last June, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. fired all 17 members of the Vaccine Advisory Committee. Many of his hand-picked replacements are vaccine skeptics or even outright opponents. Retsef Levy, a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management, is a vaccine panel member. He called the risk of infection from hepatitis B extremely low and claimed that vaccines in general haven't been sufficiently studied.
I suggest to parents to be very, very suspicious when people tell them that something is safe, especially a vaccine, because we have been adopting a very, very confident way of telling parents about vaccine products that they are completely safe, where we essentially never tested them appropriately.
Vaccine supporters say the Hep B vaccine has undergone thorough studies and is safe and effective. Republican Senator Bill Cassidy, a liver doctor who chairs the Senate Health Committee, called the advisory committee vote on the hepatitis B vaccine a mistake, which will make America sicker. Cassidy voted to confirm Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. after he said he received assurances that Kennedy would not make changes in the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Those assurances have been breached. The acting director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Jim O'Neill, is expected to decide later whether to accept the committee's recommendations. I'm Eileen Alfandari for KPFA News.
Newly released recordings of 911 calls show Texas residents and staffers at Camp Mystic caught up in the catastrophic flooding in July, pleaded for help as rushing waters rose around them, stranding them in attics and on rooftops. The floods over the July 4th weekend killed at least 136 people, including at least 117 in rural Kerr County, many of them children. Emergency dispatchers there fielded more than 400 911 calls during the 6 hours when floods began to overwhelm the region. Texas authorities released the audio today. Kerrville Police Chief Chris McCall has said the calls are distressing and difficult to hear. The Federal Reserve's preferred measure of inflation slowed a bit in September, likely easing the way to a widely expected interest rate cut by the central bank next week. Marcela Sanchez has more.
The Commerce Department said prices rose 0.3% in September from August and was the same increase as the previous month. The data indicates that core inflation was muted in September, strengthening the case for a cut to the Federal Reserve's key interest rate at its next meeting. Consumer spending did grow in September, though at a slower monthly pace than in August. Incomes rose at a solid 0.4% in September for the second straight month. The Federal Reserve is facing a tricky decision next week. It would typically keep rates high to fight inflation. At the same time, it's worried about weak hiring and a slowly rising unemployment rate. Marcela Sanchez, Washington.
Football's international governing body has given its new Peace Prize to President Trump. It's an unusual break from tradition for the sport-focused organization, whose president, Gianni Infantino, has become a close ally of President Trump. The ceremony took place today during the 2026 World Cup draw at the Kennedy Center in Washington.
Is this your prize? Is this your Peace Prize? There is also a beautiful medal for you that you can wear everywhere you want to go.
I'm gonna wear it right now.
Okay, let me hold. Fantastic. Excellent.
It comes as after Trump had openly campaigned for the Nobel Peace Prize, which was awarded to Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado. FIFA President Gianni Infantino had said he thought Trump should have won the Nobel this year for his efforts to broker a ceasefire in Gaza and for other diplomatic efforts. FIFA has given no details about the process for choosing a winner. When Infantino first announced last month that the organization would give out a Peace Prize, some of its senior officials were caught off guard, learning about it through reports in the news media. Meanwhile, President Trump has finally met with Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum. Their long-delayed face-to-face discussions focused on next year's World Cup, trade and tariffs, with immigration taking a back seat. Trump has been in office more than 10 months, and usually meeting with Mexico's leader is often a priority for incoming U.S. presidents. Trump and Sheinbaum were set to meet in June at the G7 in Canada, but that was canceled. Along with Trump and Sheinbaum, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney also attended the World Cup draw in Washington today, and the three met privately afterward. Mexico remains the United States' largest trading partner, though the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement is now currently under review. The three North American countries will co-host the World Cup tournament next year. Streaming giant Netflix will buy Warner Brothers Studios and its HBO Max streaming service, along with other Warner Brothers assets. More from Mitch McCann.
The deal will see Netflix buy two of Warner Brothers Discovery's most valuable assets, its film studios as well as its streaming service HBO Max, for a reported $72 billion, representing the takeover of one of Hollywood's oldest and most acclaimed businesses by a streaming giant. The bidding war for Warner Brothers Discovery's assets was well publicized and included bids from other entertainment giants like Paramount and Comcast. Netflix co-chief executive said the move was a rare opportunity. The deal, which doesn't include Warner Brothers Discovery's TV networks like CNN, are expected to be finalized in the third quarter of 2026. U.S. business network CNBC is reporting that the White House views the deal with, quote, heavy skepticism. Mitch McCann, New York.
Indiana's House of Representatives has passed a new congressional map that could gain Republicans two seats in Congress from that state. The legislation now advances to the state Senate, where it's unclear if enough lawmakers will support its final passage. House lawmakers voted 57-41 today to approve the new congressional districts. It's part of a national push by President Trump for GOP-led states to redistrict in the middle of the decade and give Republicans an advantage in next year's midterm elections. Democratic Indiana State Representative Matt Pierce said changing maps mid-decade violates long-established norms.
First, to have a president say, wow, I'm going to have a rough midterm, so I better go out and start asking states to redraw their maps in the middle of the decade, something not normally done, so that I can maintain control of Congress. Basically saying, I need to cheat to win.
For weeks, the top Republican of the state Senate has said the chamber does not have the votes for redistricting. But lawmakers have for months been under intense pressure from the White House itself to create a new map. Republican Indiana State House Speaker Todd Houston says the vote reflects the politics of the moment.
I don't think what we do here will stop other states from doing it. I think that this is the place where we are right now. This is our time to act.
The bill now heads to the state Senate for a vote. New York Attorney General Letitia James is challenging the authority of an acting U.S. attorney in Albany, New York, who is investigating her. Her lawyers argue John Sarcone's appointment was improper, making subpoenas he issued invalid. The dispute centers on Sarcone's role in investigating cases against President Trump and the National Rifle Association. Federal lawyers maintain Sarcone's position is legitimate and the subpoenas should stand. James's lawyers argue the subpoenas are invalid due to the improper way Sarcone was placed in the position by U.S. Attorney General Pamela Bondi. This comes as President Trump's other efforts to appoint political loyalists as federal prosecutors face legal challenges. Indiana is one of 26 states with a certified abandoned mine land program. It's designed to eliminate health, safety, and environmental hazards left behind by unpermitted mining. More from Terry D.
Governor Mike Braun has praised Indiana as one of the nation's top coal-producing states and says the state is equipped to reclaim rare earth elements from coal and coal byproducts through rare earth recovery. Director of the Abandoned Mine Land Program, Kit Turpin, says sites mined before 1977 and left in an unreclaimed condition are eligible for federal funding.
On these abandoned mines, there's these coal-processing waste piles that are left behind. We call them gob piles. They have rare earth elements in them, and right now they're sitting on the landscape, and in many cases, they're impacting the waterways of Indiana.
Gob piles are mixtures of coal, rock, and other debris that lack vegetation and can be environmentally hazardous due to acid mine drainage. Braun says Indiana's and America's future strength depends on the state's ability to lead in rare earth element production, which is essential to economic security and national defense. To fix GOP piles that are emitting acid mine drainage is costly. If the problem cannot be eliminated, Turbin fears there will be an ongoing legacy of treating water to mitigate the drainage's effects on the surrounding area.
If there was a process that could responsibly take these materials and move them off the landscape and to a processor that could then pull these rare earth elements, critical minerals out of it, then we would be effectively eliminating this environmental problem from the landscape.
The U.S. Geological Survey reports that the world depends on China for 70% of rare earth metal production, 90% of rare earth metal processing, and 12 of 50 critical minerals. I'm Terry D. reporting.
Legislation in the New York State Legislature would reinforce deadlines for the state to reimburse nonprofit organizations for the wide variety of public services they provide in New York. More from Edwin J. Vieira.
The bill changes the state's contracting law to address nonprofits' challenges getting paid by the state for everything from social services to disaster recovery. The New York Council on Nonprofits finds the state owes $650 million to nonprofit groups, with more than half worried about how they'll operate without these funds. Dr. Sharon McLennan Weir with the Center for Independence of the Disabled New York says many nonprofits struggle as they wait for state dollars.
What happens a lot of the times is that these nonprofits are using whatever reserves they have. If their reserves run out, they're using lines of credit, and when that runs out, they are essentially out of business.
Research indicates nonprofit groups must often take out interest-bearing loans and then absorb the interest payments. McLennan Weir adds the government shutdown greatly affected groups like Sydney when federal money didn't trickle down to the states. The bill has been delivered to Governor Kathy Hochul. Sydney is owed a little more than $2 million from the state for contracts and has waited several months to receive it. McLennan Weir says there's a lack of transparency about it, noting nonprofits are often given the runaround when trying to collect these funds.
What we hear is, okay, well, we're working on it, or you need to resubmit this or resubmit that. Oh, yes, we received this, but you didn't have this on that particular line. Please resubmit. When we resubmit, they say, oh, yes, we're working on it. We'll get back to you in a few days. And then before you know it, another week, another month. It's insanity.
A 2023 State Comptroller report notes more than 5,000 contracts between the state and nonprofits were processed late, which limits the work groups like Sydney can do. McLennan Weir notes between October 2024 and October 2025, her group saw more than 73,000 people across New York City without prompt payment. She says some organizations could pass a fiscal point of no return.
We don't have reserves forever. We're not a for-profit corporation with millions and billions of dollars. We're not. Every dollar that comes into Sydney and any other nonprofit like an independent living center goes right out, because every dollar we put in, we're putting it right back into service delivery.
This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection.
California U.S. Senator Adam Schiff announced a bill today in San Francisco that he says would help alleviate both homelessness and the housing affordability crisis. San Francisco Mayor Daniel Lurie was among those on hand for the release of what's being called the Housing Boom Act. Rook Kirkner has more.
BOOM is an acronym, Building Occupancy Opportunities for Millions. A goal the bill plans to achieve through several channels, like the expansion of funding for the construction of middle-income housing, services for the unhoused population, tenant support, and protections against housing discrimination.
The problem today is that people are working, and they still can't afford to get by. They still can't afford a place to live. So many families are rent-burdened or housing-burdened or mortgage-burdened in the state of California. More than 30% of our residents spend more than 30% of their income on housing. And there's no way to solve that problem unless we're building a lot more housing.
That was Senator Adam Schiff addressing a small crowd gathered on the roof of the newly constructed Sophie Maxwell Building. Named after a former San Francisco supervisor, the building contains 105 housing units slated to house families making less or just above the average median income, which in San Francisco is $125,000. The Maxwell Building dictates rent based on household income within the range of $1,200 to $3,600 a month. The middle-income housing development is the first in a series of planned developments on the former Potrero Power Station, located on San Francisco's central eastern waterfront. Enrique Landa is the managing partner of Associate Capital, the project's development firm. He described the difficulty of financing the Sophie Maxwell Building and expressed hopes that the Housing Boom Act would lift some of those barriers to new middle-income construction.
We're sitting on a building that is the first privately financed workforce housing project that has been built in the city in a very long time. It's because of a tool that got put out in 2008 during the Great Recession, and the Obama administration put out a rule to be able to use municipal debt to be able to be recycled to build buildings like this. It took 17 years to use that tool. It was a very hard process. It took us 5 banks, 6 law firms, 3 consulting firms, a nonprofit, you name it. But it was the willingness to prove that we need to build housing for everybody to get cities to work.
Senator Schiff's website cites the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, saying the U.S. has a shortage of at least 7.1 million homes that are affordable to low-income renters. For every 100 extremely low-income renter households in California, there are just 30 affordable and available rental homes. The Boom Act, if passed, would institute a wide swath of housing reforms, like tripling the low-income housing tax credit and establishing a $10 billion annual loan fund for families earning 60 to 120% of the average median income. It would also increase funding for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, establishing a language access plan for individuals with limited English proficiency who seek federal housing assistance. Democratic Representative Latifa Simon is set to introduce companion legislation for this bill in the House of Representatives. But the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has not yet estimated the cost of the bill, which would rely primarily on the expansion of federal tax credits. However, approval seems unlikely, given the Republican majority in Washington and President Trump's vehement dislike of Senator Schiff, who he once called the lowest form of scum. Regardless, the 2025 California Affordable Housing Report cites that policy change is necessary to meet our housing needs, as median rent in California has increased by 40% since 2000, while the median renter household income has only increased by 9%. For KPFA News, I'm Brooke Helena Kirchner.
The Guardian is reporting that the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, have been working to destroy evidence of their massacre in the northern Sudanese city of El Fasher. Satellite imagery shows large piles of bodies heaped throughout its streets to await burial in mass graves or cremation in huge pits. The capital of North Darfur State is still sealed off to outsiders, including United Nations war crimes investigators. But satellite evidence has revealed a network of newly dug incineration and burial pits thought to be for the disposal of large numbers of bodies. Nathaniel Raymond is executive director of the Humanitarian Research Lab at Yale Law School.
What we've seen has been clear evidence of house-to-house killings, clearance operations, consistent with the videos that the Rapid Support Forces themselves have posted of them indiscriminately shooting civilians, particularly men and boys. We have seen mass graves in at least 5 locations. We've seen mass graves and burning pits with evidence of objects consistent with human remains inside the pits.
While the final death toll of the massacre remains unclear, British members of Parliament have been briefed that at least 60,000 have been murdered in El Fasher. The Rapid Support Forces are an offshoot of the Janjaweed Arab militias who carried out the Darfur genocide against East African tribes in the early 2000s. Nathaniel Raymond of Yale Law School's Humanitarian Research Lab says the RSF are back to finish the job.
These civilians are Zagawa in 4, meaning they are of 2 of the 3 main tribes that were targeted in the 2003-2005 Darfur genocide. And so what we're looking at here is not a new genocide. People often say, is the specter of genocide looming again in Darfur? No, it's not looming again. The genocide is being completed. And that's what we were trying to communicate.
Human rights groups, including Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, have said that the United Arab Emirates, a key U.S. Gulf ally, has been arming, funding, and training the RSF, a claim the UAE denies. The Guardian reports that as many as 150,000 residents of El Fasher remain unaccounted for, since the city fell to the RSF. They are not thought to have left the city. And this grisly development comes amid increasingly gloomy speculation about their fate. President Trump has come out with a new national security strategy that paints European allies as weak and aims to reassert American dominance in the Western Hemisphere. The document, released today by the White House, is sure to upset longstanding U.S. allies in Europe for its scathing critiques of their migration and free speech policies. It suggests those allies face the prospect of civilizational erasure and raises doubts about their long-term reliability as American partners. The document reinforces the U.S. commitment to the Republican president's America First philosophy. Germany's foreign minister acknowledges the U.S. is Germany's most important NATO ally, but says questions about freedom of expression are not part of alliance discussions. And you are listening to the Pacifica Evening News on KPFA Berkeley and KPFK Los Angeles. This newscast airs each night at 6 o'clock. Back with more news after this.
818-985-5735. We just heard the voice of Max Pringle, a good friend of mine. I met him with Mitch Jesuits back in the day. And, of course, the other great folks there like Eileen Alfandary, Christopher Martinez. This is News for California, an award-winning newscast. 818-985-5735 is a number to call to pledge your support for the news, the Pacifica Evening News, an award-winning newscast, better than KTLA and better than CNN because, you know, those shows, those programs, they go to different topics and they don't really stay on some of the news that we want to hear, the news we want to hear, and the news we deserve to hear. 818-985-5735. So we're taking this break, just a short break, to ask you to go to your phones and support the KPFK Pacifica Evening News, because these guys spend all day putting the news together. Most of them are volunteers. I believe they have one news director. But I was there at the KPFK and KPFA news department, so I know what it's like to have to put together a newscast. It's very, very hard, and to put the topics together. So, folks, we're going to go back to the news with Max Pringle, but we're asking you to go to your phones and support it. 818-985-5735. We really need to raise the funds, and call now. Back to the news. 818-985-5735. Or pledge online at kpfk.org. We need to keep the Pacifica Evening News on our airwaves, so we're going to break right back into the news.
It was due to be announced next week. Now it's been kicked back until the middle of next month. Chung-Ching Kwong is a senior analyst with the Interparliamentary Alliance on China, which campaigns for accountability across all aspects of Western relations with Beijing.
I won't be very surprised if Keir Starmer say yes, because it has been, there's rumors ongoing for a long time that the Labour government is going to approve it. Keir Starmer is planning to go to China next year, and I think they're still holding on to the idea that we can get more investment, more money from China, and they will be able to bail us out of this very difficult economic situation in the UK right now. But a lot of the other countries, like the US, Switzerland, Netherlands, Sweden, parliamentarians and the government have all voiced concern. So it's very difficult to understand why the government will still want to go ahead, given all the risks and allies raising concerns.
China says the UK is complicating and politicizing the issue and is strongly urging approval of its planning application. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
President Trump's advisors and Ukrainian officials say they'll meet for a third day of talks on Saturday after making progress on finding agreement on a security framework for post-war Ukraine. The two sides also offered the sober assessment that any real progress toward any agreement ultimately will depend on what they said are Russia's readiness to show serious commitment to long-term peace. A statement from U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, President Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, as well as Ukrainian negotiators Rustin Umarov and Andrei Hanatov, came after they met for a second day in Florida today. They offered only broad brushstrokes about the progress they say that's been made as Trump pushes Kyiv and Moscow to agree to a U.S.-mediated proposal to end nearly 4 years of war. The U.S. and Ukrainian officials also discussed deterrence capabilities that Ukraine will need to sustain a lasting peace. Witkoff and Kushner's talks in Florida with Umarov, Ukraine's lead negotiator, and Anatov follow discussions between Russian President Vladimir Putin and the U.S. envoys at the Kremlin earlier this week. The deputy prosecutor of the International Criminal Court says that the investigation into the invasion of the Ukraine cannot be halted by peace talks, but could be deferred by the UN Security Council. Negotiators and officials from the U.S., Ukraine, and Russia have crisscrossed the globe in recent weeks in a flurry of meetings to discuss a potential deal. The court has issued arrest warrants for Russian President Vladimir Putin and five others over their alleged involvement in war crimes in Ukraine. India's central bank has cut its key interest rate to 5.25%. Reporter Rebecca Bundon has more from Mumbai.
India's economy is experiencing a rare Goldilocks period, according to RBI Governor Sanjay Malhotra, as he made the announcement of the 25 basis point rate cut. The cut had been predicted by many economists. Inflation has eased rapidly in India, which gave the central bank the scope to trim rates to help support economic growth.
And that's Rebecca Bundon in Mumbai. Russian President Vladimir Putin has held talks with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi at an annual summit between the two countries, focusing on diversifying economic ties. Charles de Ledesma has more.
The 23rd Russia-India summit comes at a pivotal moment as the U.S. pushes for a Ukraine peace deal while seeking global cooperation. It will test New Delhi's efforts to balance relations with Moscow and Washington as the nearly four-year war in Ukraine grinds on. According to Indian officials involved in preparations for the summit, the agenda includes talks on defense, energy and labor mobility. Putin was received by Modi at an airport in New Delhi on Thursday, who gave the visiting leader a bear hug and a tight handshake with the gusto of an old friend. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
President Trump's White House has established what it's calling a hall of shame for journalists it finds guilty of media bias as it looks for new avenues of attack against legacy news outlets. The Republican president has been criticizing so-called fake news since his first term. Some of Trump's attacks have turned personal in the past month. Yet, despite it all, the news outlet Axios pointed out this week that mainstream news sources are as dominant as ever in setting the agenda for Washington and, somewhat ironically, capturing the president's attention. The Washington Post says it, quote, will continue to report rigorously and accurately in service to all of the country. The government picked a company with little experience working with the Federal Aviation Administration called Peraton to oversee the roughly $31.5 billion overhaul of the outdated air traffic control system. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said Thursday evening that Peraton was chosen in the hope that its innovative approach will make it possible to complete the upgrades within the next 3 years before the end of President Trump's current term in office ends. Earlier this year, Congress approved $12.5 billion as a down payment on the project after a series of technical problems demonstrated how fragile and outdated the current system is. This effort to upgrade the technology controllers use is on a much more aggressive timeline than the previous projects. Members of Congress are demanding answers after learning the U.S. military fired on two survivors clinging to the wreckage of a suspected drug smuggling boat near Venezuela. The September strike was the first U.S. operation to destroy alleged drug boats with missiles. On Thursday, Admiral Frank Bradley briefed lawmakers behind closed doors. He denied receiving any order from Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to, quote, kill them all, a claim raised in earlier reporting by the Washington Post. But Democrats say the video of the attack is disturbing, showing two unarmed survivors on a capsized boat before the final strike, calling it a possible war crime. Meanwhile, U.S. Southern Command, that is, says more people were killed Thursday in the 22nd U.S. strike on suspected drug boats since September, a campaign that's now killed at least 87 people. President Trump has hinted that land attacks inside Venezuela may be coming next. As a result, protests are planned Saturday in more than 60 cities nationwide, opposing what the organizers call the administration's push toward war. Demonstrators, including Sonika Muhajan with the Answer Coalition, say the public does not want more forever wars.
Over 70% of Americans are very decidedly opposed to this war. And really, the majority of Americans are opposed to any more war.
Across the country, more than 70 events are part of the No War on Venezuela National Day of Action, all taking place tomorrow, December 6th. Actions are planned here in California in Fresno, L.A., Sacramento, and San Francisco, among dozens of other cities.
We have the chance to stop this war before it began.
Organizers say that 22 years after the U.S. went to war in Iraq, based on false claims, the Trump administration is now laying the groundwork for a major war in Venezuela. And they argue the public must act now to stop a new conflict before it begins. Massachusetts's highest court heard oral arguments today in the state's lawsuit arguing that Meta designed features on Facebook and Instagram to make them addictive to young users. The lawsuit, filed last year by State Attorney General Andrea Campbell, alleges that Meta did this to make a profit and that its actions affected hundreds of thousands of teens in Massachusetts who use the social media platforms. The lawsuit is among a growing number that have been filed in federal and state court against Meta, which argues it has taken a number of steps to keep children safe online. This Sunday, December 7th, is the deadline for changing Medicare plans under open enrollment. Experts say the most important thing to do is to make sure your doctors accept the plan that you've chosen for 2026 or find out which plans they will take. Suzanne Potter has more.
Stephanie Fahuri is Program Director for the Health Insurance Counseling and Advocacy Program at the Center for Healthcare Rights in Los Angeles.
Every year during open enrollment, we see people that make a choice about their coverage without confirming with their providers whether or not they're in network or whether they take that type of coverage. And then come January, they are faced with a predicament where they are in a plan and cannot see their doctors.
Every Medicare beneficiary should have received a letter from their insurance company explaining any changes to their 2026 offerings. Anthem Blue Cross, for example, will no longer offer its Medicare Part D drug plan in California next year, and they're not the only one. This year, Californians had a choice of 16 Medicare Part D plans. Next year, it will drop to 12. You can compare Medicare plans offered in your zip code online at Medicare.gov. Fahuri says a little research might turn up a plan that fits your needs at a lower price.
Each year, many of the plans go up in cost, but might not actually be providing any additional benefits. So we've helped a number of folks switch their drug plans to a less expensive option, and they're maintaining the same amount of coverage.
People on covered California plans have until January 31st to make changes. Open enrollment dates for employer-based coverage varies by company, and Medi-Cal enrollment is open year-round. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Recalled former Alameda County District Attorney Pamela Price says she'll run again in the June 2026 primary election for her old job. Pamela Price won the 2022 general election for Alameda County DA, but was recalled by nearly two-thirds of voters last year. Recall organizers had criticized her as too soft on crime. She announced on Thursday that she would seek the office again, billing her campaign as a fight against billionaires, corporate corruption, and people aligned with President Trump. Current District Attorney Ursula Jones Dixon was appointed by the Alameda County Board of Supervisors. In a statement, Jones Dixon said she inherited a demoralized office and a charging backlog from her predecessor. She said she trusts the judgment of voters who ousted Price. Christina Onestad has more.
Pamela Price says her decision to rerun for Alameda County District Attorney is recent. Back in June, she had no intention of trying to make a comeback after she was recalled last year with 63% of the vote. But that changed when President Donald Trump sent federal troops to Alameda.
We have seen the invasion of Alameda County by federal agents and a political establishment and a district attorney who has said nothing. While other jurisdictions, DAs in other jurisdictions, have taken heed of that and have taken accountability to protect the residents of this county. That is not happening here.
The civil rights attorney turned progressive prosecutor doubled down her first campaign pledge that helped put her into office, holding the powerful to account.
Federal agents, including ICE, Customs and Border Patrol, FBI, DEA, and the Federalized National Guard can be prosecuted for assault, kidnapping, child endangerment, vehicle violations like reckless driving or leaving the scene of an accident, and any other crimes against our residents. In jurisdictions across the country where district attorneys have stood up and said that we will enforce the law, ICE had been restrained.
Price condemned the ICE shooting of a pastor, Jorge Bautista, with a chemical agent during demonstrations.
You do not shoot pastors who are praying for you. It happened in Chicago and it happened in Oakland. And nothing has been done about that.
As district attorney, Price tells KPFA News she prosecuted nearly a dozen cases against law enforcement misconduct through the public accountability unit she set up. Since her ouster, several of those high-profile prosecutions have faltered with a new appointed district attorney, Ursula Jones Dixon.
There has been the destruction of the public accountability unit and a clear bias in favor of law enforcement, a refusal to prosecute and hold law enforcement accountable. And that is dangerous in the time of Trump. Because if you won't hold local law enforcement accountable, how can we expect you to protect us when federal agents violate our civil rights?
Price, the first Black woman DA of Alameda County, faced a well-funded recall campaign, primarily by the tech and real estate industries, and a coal magnate, Peter Dreyfus, who lives in Piedmont. The campaign pushed narratives Price was soft on crime and to blame for rising crime rates. She had been in the role less than 2 years. After she was recalled, the ACLU of Northern California noted violent crime was actually down 30% in Oakland. Overall crime down 19%. Price compared her recall supporters to the oligarchs in the White House.
We need to show Donald Trump and his billionaire friends, whether they're in Washington or Piedmont, that justice is not for sale in Alameda County.
Price says the actual data showed she had higher rates of prosecutions than her predecessor in the same time period she was in office. She then took aim at rising gun crime in Oakland, pointing to two high-profile school shootings. She slammed new tough-on-crime policies D.A. Dixon announced, returning mandatory minimums in the wake of a shooting death of a Laney College coach, the suspect with a mental illness.
This gentleman had a lawful possession of a gun. And so the question whether a mandatory minimum would apply to him, it would not. So obviously that's not a solution. That's a political point that was made at a time when our community was reeling from this insane death, from this tragic death.
Price says her crime reduction strategies were proven ones that she's ready to build on in her next term.
We will crack down on gun dealers and the illegal sale of guns in this county. And so we are here to correct the record.
But in the era of fake news, that's something her campaign will probably spend a lot of time having to do. Voters will ultimately weigh in again, June 2026. I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for KPFA Pacifica Radio.
A coastal flood advisory is in effect until Sunday across California. Forecasters say up to 1.4 feet of flooding above ground level is possible in low-lying areas near shorelines and tidal waterways. The cause? An annual astronomical tidal event, one that scientists say offers a preview of what California's coastlines will look like in the future as climate change accelerates sea level rise. Lauren Schmidt has more.
The highest tides of the year, the king tides, are back along the coast. They happen when the sun and the moon line up just right with the Earth, pulling the ocean a little higher than usual. And scientists say the extra high tides give us a glimpse of what sea level rise could look like along California's coastline in the years ahead.
King tides are the highest projected tides of the winter, and they're about 1 to 1.5 feet higher than the average high tides that we see throughout the rest of the year.
That was Annie Kohut-Frankel with the California Coastal Commission, who says sea levels are expected to rise anywhere from about 1.5 to 3 feet over the next 75 years. And these astronomical tide events show us a glimpse into the future. The commission is asking the public to take part in their virtual King Tides project by snapping photos of the shoreline during the high tide events, which will help document the changes underway and guide planning efforts to protect vulnerable communities.
Taking photos and sharing those photos helps us with a number of things. One, we're creating a living record of changes to our shoreline. And then it also helps us understand what's going to be vulnerable to sea level rise in the near future, because since king tides are 1 to 1.5 feet higher than the average high tides, that's about what we expect to see due to human-caused sea level rise over the next few decades.
Along the California coast, some regions will experience more severe impacts than others, like Imperial Beach in San Diego County to Humboldt Bay in the North State, which is seeing some of the fastest rates of relative sea level rise on the West Coast. Researchers like Dr. Christina Hill, the Associate Professor of Urban Design, Landscape, Architecture, and Environmental Planning at UC Berkeley, says these events anticipate the impacts, which already show that low-income communities and communities of color will likely be the most impacted, particularly in the Bay Area.
Absolutely. I mean, well, just to step back for a second, sea level rise has already come up. Sea level has come up 400 feet since the last glacial era, which was 22,000 years ago. So sea level has risen a lot as the climate changed in the past. But what's happening now is we've had a very slow rate of sea level rise over the last 8,000 or so years during the period when we developed cities. And this is the first time in human history that cities will have to adapt to a rapid sea level rise. And one of the ways that we've kind of blown it in cities is that we've isolated people who are treated as other by the majority population, and we've made them live in places where there are factories or military bases, and up until the 1960s, didn't let people of color live in white neighborhoods through housing covenants or redlining. So we isolated people who were different from the white majority in places that were low-lying, near the shoreline, where flooding already occurred. And a lot of those neighborhoods are still at risk, like the Canal District in San Rafael, East Oakland around the airport, Richmond, and West Berkeley. Lots of places are going to be impacted that were the places where we put workers' housing and restricted people of color to live in those areas.
Dr. Hill's work examines the projected impacts and develops strategies for how communities can adapt. But according to Dr. Hill, the cracks in the city's infrastructure are already showing, literally, as water is seeping through the concrete barriers that are meant to keep rising tides out, like the Lake Merritt Tidal Gate in Oakland and other parts of the East Bay, where king tides are flooding pedestrian tunnels and low-lying pathways. She says cities need to begin an adaptation lift.
And that bigger lift probably is going to be stuff that looks like what we don't have right now. It's going to look different, like the floating fire station that people have built in San Francisco. We're going to have to think about how to live with higher water, like the Dutch have, but also in an environment where we support biodiversity and we live with earthquakes.
And while some of the risks and negative impacts of sea level rise are still years into the future, others are already happening.
We're seeing problems like the flooding of a new affordable housing project in Oakland at the Oakland Coliseum called Coliseum Connections. That happened in part because groundwater was really shallow, pushed up by rising seas and tides. And other places where there are contaminated sites left over from old military bases or chemical factories, there are chemicals in the ground that are moving into sewer pipes that could enter people's homes or schools as groundwater is being pushed upwards. And we don't have to wait to see 2 feet of sea level rise for that. That's a game of inches, and we're already starting to see that happen.
The impacts may be unavoidable, but Kohut Frankel with the Coastal Commission says there's still time to act.
We are seeing sea level rise. We will see sea level rise, but the amount that we ultimately experience on this planet really depends on how quickly we stop burning fossil fuels.
For KPFA News, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
A federal judge has given the Justice Department permission to release transcripts of a grand jury investigation into Jeffrey Epstein's abuse of underage girls in Florida. The case ultimately ended without any federal charges being filed against the millionaire sex offender. U.S. District Judge Rodney Smith said today that a recently passed federal law ordering the release of records related to the cases overrode the usual rules about grand jury secrecy. The need for blood donations is highest in the winter months, but experts say it's also one of the most difficult times to get donations as people are busy with holiday travel and preparations. Simone Perez has more.
Blood can't be artificially manufactured, so people need to donate blood at their local blood bank to keep up the supply. Each day, the Red Cross alone must receive nearly 400 donations in the Washington, D.C. metro area just to keep up with the demand from hospitals. Scott Martyr is with the American Red Cross of the National Capital and Greater Chesapeake Region. He says sometimes holiday preparations and travel can keep regular donors from making an appointment.
The need for blood is constant. Every 2 seconds, someone in this country needs a blood transfusion. And it could be for any one of a bunch of reasons. People battling cancer, mothers who are facing complications during childbirth, or accident victims who need emergency surgery. The Red Cross urges donors during the holiday months to come out and donate.
Even though more than 60% of Marylanders are eligible to donate blood, only 3% do. According to America's Blood Centers, just a 1% increase in donors would alleviate blood shortages. Martyr explains that a person is in need of a blood transfusion every 2 seconds in the United States. He adds that blood donations can extend far beyond Maryland. If the local blood supply is strong, but another community has a shortage, blood can be sent to that area. The reverse also applies to Maryland.
Let's say we're short on B negative blood. We can ship blood from other areas here into this area so that there's enough B negative blood so that patients can receive that care.
To find a local blood drive, you can visit redcrossblood.org and enter your zip code for a list of blood drives near you. I'm Simone Perez, Maryland News Connection.
Celebrated Canadian-American architect Frank Gehry, known for his imaginative genre-shifting designs, has died. He was 96. He's known for iconic works such as the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, and the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles. Over his prolific career, Gehry received architecture's highest honors, including the Pritzker Prize and Canada's Companion of the Order. Partly cloudy tonight in the San Francisco Bay Area, lows in the 40s. Tomorrow, clear, highs in the 50s. In the Central Valley, clear tonight, lows around 40. Sunny tomorrow, highs in the 50s. In the L.A. area, clear tonight, overnight lows in the 40s. Sunny tomorrow, highs in the 60s. That's it for the news tonight. I'm Max Pringle. Rod Akil is at the controls. Good evening.
KPFK, it's actually my favorite radio station, and the reason I love them is because they are bold and they are representative.
KPFK is holding its year-end fund drive from December 2nd through the